Right, thank you very much, Adam. Yeah, it's very informative and very thorough. So, yeah, as before, yeah, people tuning in over Zoom will be able to sort of, contribute as well. We're putting their hands up, and myself and Piers will juggle the technicalities. So, yeah, thanks again, Adam. And, yeah, any contributions or questions? Stunned into silence. Oh, yeah, go on, Tom. Yeah, I thought you would.
Yeah. Is this the 5-minute argument or the pull-off hour?
It seems to me that if you look at the political...
Speak up a bit.
I thought I was speaking up. I'll try and project.
It seems to me that if you look at the political problem of Leninism, that is like a vanguardist organisation, it's that you are working within what is a capitalist society, and you are trying to take it over without sort of changing what the working class are until you're already there, if you sort of mean. So you're assuming that the working class can't come to more than the consciousness that they have within capitalism. So you're not actually what you're doing is you are changing the power structures, but you're not changing the what you're actually dealing with. You're not changing, if you like, the physical nature of the society you're in. You're just saying that it used to be run by capitalists, but now it is being run by a committee of a vanguard doing it for the working class, but it is still only intention, if you see what I mean, that the capitalists could take it back at any point, and in fact it is still in the state that the capitalists could take it back far more easily than the vanguard could keep it. And in fact, that's what we saw in Russia. I mean, you know, that's why we say you can't have socialism in one country or whatever it is, because you still have capitalism outside as a pressure of where it would be much easier for that nation that has tried to be controlled by the working class to be capitalist than to be socialist, though even though in this case we're really only talking about state capitalism even taking its logical conclusion. So it seems to me that you have this problem of I think Orwell spoke about the rough men who stand at the gates or whatever, that any society has to allow for the violence that is required to keep it constituted. And if you don't revolutionise the very nature of the... oh, God, I'm looking at myself. I hate that. Cheers, mate. If you don't revolutionise the nature of the conflict in society, it is still in a form that the capitalists can take it back more easily than you can keep it, and you are constantly in a state of violence. You need to make it incoherent for capitalists to take it over. Now, we have a theory that if we get rid of all of the capitalists, that basically we don't have this problem of in one country, we've got rid of all the capitalists everywhere, and therefore we can run it as we see fit. But I think that we will still encounter the problem that unless we then go on to fundamentally change what it is that we are doing in a way that is not expressed by my favourite bugbear, socialism as a practical alternative, that we will still be faced with the problem that even if there are no capitalists, we would still have a structure within which we would be having to hold that structure in tension to prevent capitalists from coming along and coming back. We would have to take a further step that we don't usually discuss in order to change that society that we have now taken over in toto. But we now have to change that society further into one that cannot slip back into what it was.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, Adam, did you want to reply to...
Well, two things. Marx was never a Leninist in that sense. But the main question is, Simon, you're talking about we do this, we're going to do that. Who do you mean by we? You don't mean the Socialist Party, I take it. But you don't mean it's a minority of socialists, because we will be everybody, or everybody who is a majority was a socialist. So I think it's a presumption anyway that they wouldn't have established socialism in the first place if they didn't know what socialism involved and you know, what needed to be done. So anyway, who do you mean by we?
Yeah, to answer that, I would say that, you know, the assumption is that even if we as a working class are acting, we express it via a political party, I mean that the Socialist Party is set up to be that, you know, to be like the world's smallest mass party. And to take over political structures, you have to do it in a certain way, even if you intend to then overthrow those structures. So the thought would be that somehow, you know, whether it's expressed through the electoral process or whether it's expressed through the or whether it's expressed through another process, then there's still going to be either our name tag or someone else's name tag or name tags on that, and there will be some kind of organisation. And I think by not looking at that, you're burying precisely the problem that I was trying to talk about. You're assuming that the working class has already solved that problem of a socialist society before they get to it, whereas I think that's really an idealistic position. I don't think that you can do that apart from in that process of taking it over. So I don't think that we can do this thing of the working class sitting down one day and deciding, yes, we've got a better idea than capitalism, and then we go on and then there's just a big kerfuffle. I think that the working class, will be addressing it with entirely capitalist notions, including ourselves. We will have oppositional capitalist notions, but we won't have the kind of notions that we're going to need to manage the society that comes after us, and we necessarily can't have, because we haven't been in a situation to make those ideas. So we are going to be in a situation of trying to take over society while at the same time trying to revolutionise it. But we have to assume that we will be doing it, you know, within the capitalist mindset as it applies to the working class, and that we are going to have to go through a process of overthrowing those structures in turn.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? Edmund.
Thank you, Adam. That was a really interesting, thought-provoking talk. And I think it does establish that there were elements in Marx, or as you say, a phase in the development of Marx and Engels' thinking that Lenin could latch on to. I think even if there hadn't been, he would still have latched on to Marxism. And I think would not have been being subjectively insincere in doing so. I mean, if you think of the French Revolution, which was mentioned in the tour, Robespierre believed that he was implementing Rousseau or whatever, the advanced theory that was available at that time. The English revolutionaries in the 17th century believed that they were following Puritan theology, or whatever it might be. If the exact same French Revolution had happened after Marx had written rather than before, it's slightly nonsensical. But I'm sure Robespierre would have thought that he was a Marxist. Would he still have dug Rousseau out of the archives? Or would he have picked up the most advanced modern revolutionary theory and believed that that was what he was doing? So I think that's part of it. And I think another thing that came out of the tour, in a sense, this is why it's nonsensical to imagine the French Revolution not happening until after Marx, because a lot of the way Marx and Engels think about revolution is relating to the French Revolution. And that's where these ideas of revolutionary dictatorship or the 1794 or whatever it might be, it comes out of that experience. And I think part of what perhaps Marx and Engels come to realise, as you sketched out, is that the transition from capitalism to socialism doesn't look very much like the French Revolution. And the analogy of, oh, that was the bourgeois revolution, and now we're going to do the proletarian revolution. So we'll have the proletarian storming of the Bastille, and we'll have the proletarian Jacobins, and we'll have the proletarian the 7 years and the other. Often that's not a good way to think about it. So in that sense, we need to read some of the works of Marx and Engels, sort of discounting the French revolutionary element, or being aware that we are not planning to storm the Bastille. That's slightly disconnected thoughts, but that's just a couple of things that came into my head listening to you.
Right, thank you very much. Adam, did you want to...
Yes, I mean, I think Ed is right that the French Revolution sort of dominated thinking of revolutionaries, such revolutionaries, in the 19th century, in the same sort of way that the Russian Revolution did, you know, in the 20th century. And you know, I say when Marx came back to France from Germany, he was greeted as Citizen Marx, and I mean, even the when early party meetings, they would sing the Marseillaise and, thing, you know, and things like that. But it's not a model that they kept all the way through their political lives. I mean, that testament of is a political testament really, that because it was Engels wrote it in 1895, which was the year he died. All that was romanticism. It was wrong. We're now confronted with a different situation, and that is more in line with the situation here than the situation in Russia. And you can also, Lenin would probably have become a vanguardist anyway, because there's a whole tradition of Russian revolutionaries, was almost in the direct line of descent from. Leboeuf, Buonarroti, Blanqui, and their supporters in Russia. Lenin's organizational views weren't invented by him. They were taken over from previous Russian revolutionaries who were once again, say, in a direct line of descent from the from the French Revolution. In fact, Tony Cliff, who was one of the Trotskyist leaders, who had a sense of humour, he says, Lenin woke up in 1917, and he looked at his watch, and it didn't say 1917, it said 1848.
Thank you. Bill?
Three thoughts. I mean, as I was talking about last night about changes that Marx made in the Communist League, the change from being a conspiratorial organisation. Now, if you look in the various publications, the Leninists try and make out that the structure of the Communist League was a Leninist party, because there was a leading circle and that was in charge, and it was still semi-activist based. But obviously, the difference being there that leading circle was itself chosen by a conference, supposedly that was meeting annually. So it was still much more of a thoroughgoing democratic organisation than the democratic centralism as later developed by Lenin. But still very much part and parcel of what Marx was about bringing this distinction that Adam made between party as a general current and party as an organisation. Very much part of developing this concept of a party as a distinct organisation. And just there's some, at some point in the ranks, I think it's talking about President Johnson after Lincoln. They talk about, Marx talks about that they will need to use revolutionary methods. I think he misunderstood what was going on in America at that particular point. But certainly, this idea of something called revolutionary methods was still something that even as late as 1865 was still part of the way he thought about things. There is this mode of revolution of types of action. And likewise, obviously, the writings on the Paris Commune, even though, you know, talk about objective conditions and whatnot, and you know, then it was itself a democratic assembly, he was still very keen on the idea of, okay, let's seize the bank and seize the town, or the French equivalent. And, you know, more decisive action to make sure that they've got control of the money. So there's still this element of revolutionary adventurism, I think, that still continues even quite late into his career.
Thank you, yeah. Adam, did you want to reply at all?
Not really. But can I say something about the... About the Paris Commune. I mean, in the 19th, right up until the First World War, most politicians were drawn from the ranks of the bourgeoisie, or even from the ranks of the capitalist class. They all wore, you know, top hats and tails and so on. And the Paris Commune was the first time that ordinary working people, though they weren't all necessarily, you know, members of the working class as we would define it, ordinary people had a go at running society. It wasn't anything to do with socialism. It was just, you know, the ordinary people, ordinary workers, being able to administer, you know, the affairs. So even in the 20th century, I don't know when the first Labour government came in. It was probably somewhere in Australia or New Zealand, where working men were in charge of the capitalist state in the thing. So that was an event. But I mean, even that, you know, Marx was well aware that that wasn't socialism, but he was still in favour of, you know, universal suffrage and other ultra democratic changes and reforms. So I don't think, you know, the Leninists explain the failure of the Paris Commune by the absence of a vanguard party. I mean, that wasn't Marx's view, and I don't think it stands up. In fact, Leninists explain the failure of all revolutions by the absence of a vanguard party.
Any other questions, contributions?
Howard.
Adam, I wonder if we can do a bit of what-if history. What if Lenin hadn't died when he did, at a sort of fairly early stage anyway, after the Bolshevik Revolution, and then Stalin took over? What if he lived on? Would he have become the kind of ruler that Stalin was? I mean, people talk about being Marxist-Leninists. It's sort of very widespread. Nobody calls themselves a Marxist-Stalinist. Oh, I've never heard it anyway. Would the idea of sort of Lenin being an appropriate inheritor of Marx's ideas have actually survived? Had Lenin been obliged to administer state capitalism in Russia in the way that Stalin then went on to do?
No, I don't think Lenin would have been like Stalin, actually. I mean, you know, the originally misunderstood title of this meeting was advertised as, was Lenin ever a Marxist? I think Lenin did have a grasp of Marxist materialist conception of history and his Marxian economics and things. In fact, he was the person that first said that the only way forward for Russia was capitalism. But capitalism under the control of the so-called proletarian state. I think what would have happened would be that's what would have happened. They would have something like would have in China, if you like, today. That's what would have developed if Lenin had survived. I mean, I suppose the struggle after he died between Trotsky and Stalin showed how actually politically backward the Bolshevik Party was, you know, and the fact that they mummified Lenin and and this sort of thing. But I think the short answer to your question is I don't think Lenin would have behaved like Stalin. I mean, he was pretty ruthless, of course, in carrying out the terror against the Tsarists, which eventually got extended to terror against anybody that didn't support the Bolsheviks. I don't think he would have had poems, you know, saying that the sun shines out of his ass and things like that. You know?
Anyone else? Edmund?
Sorry, coming in again, if that's all right. People sometimes say, continuing from that point, people sometimes say, did Leninism lead inevitably to Stalinism? And I think, as you say, the answer is no, it didn't. It led inevitably to Brezhnevism. It didn't have to go via the kind of extravagant personal adulation of a leader and the kind of mass purges that were carried out in the 1930s. And not every Leninist government has done those. But every Leninist government has found its way to the kind of bureaucratic authoritarian apparatus that existed in the Soviet Union under Brezhnev. I think that's the natural development of the Leninist Party in power. And just on the subject of revolutionary methods and so on, revolution is an unfortunate word because, including in Marxist circles, it's used to mean two very different things. It's used to mean fundamental social change, and it's used to mean insurrection, unconstitutional change of government. And people happily talk about the Industrial Revolution. They talk about the development of capitalism as a revolution. But they also talk about, as you said, there were two revolutions in France, one in 1789 and one in 1790, whatever. Well, that's not two fundamental changes from one mode of production to another mode. But that's insurrections or changes of that's changes of government. And it is, I'm not saying that it's possible to abandon these words, and all terminology has difficulties. But we should try to be aware when we're talking about revolution that it's got two meanings that are really quite a long way apart.
Yeah, good point. Adam, did you want to
reply
on that in particular?
Well, yeah, people, when you mention the word revolution, they're still thinking of the French Revolution. They're thinking of, you know, kings being beheaded and nobles being guillotined and things like that. And so the revolution, to a lot of people, that's what it means. But it doesn't mean that to us. I mean, I think William Morris actually had an introduction in one of his talks when he said that the revolution means a change in the basis of society, and rather than the sort of thing that happened during the French Revolution. But I think that the point too about when vanguardist parties come to power, I mean, they come to power as, in their own eyes, you know, a conscious minority. In other words, they don't expect the rest of the population to necessarily agree with them. So they're in a position where they can't establish socialism because of the points that I think Simon was trying to make. The mass of the population are not socialist minded. So, you know, they're a minority in power. And for instance, in Cuba, they don't allow opposition papers because they know these will be financed by America or will be putting American propaganda. So they have to be authoritarian. They have to be, you know, dictatorships. But they're not. You know, that's the only way that Leninism can work. So if it would happen in Britain, you can't imagine it. One of these Trotskyist groups. I mean, the whole thing is just It's just ridiculous to imagine that you could have a rerun of 1917 in conditions here. But if this new left party is really infiltrated by these people and they take it over and say, we're standing for election, we must establish a workers' militia, you know, they'll get as many votes as us.
Any other questions, contributions? Yes, go ahead.
Hi, Adam. It's Kumran from the Pathways for Literate Society. I think you changed some emails recently. I wonder if you could comment on why German social democracy had selectively published Engels's 1895 preface to the class struggles in France. Just to quote Engels here, so it's a letter to Kautsky. He says, I see today in the Vorwärts an extract from my introduction, printed without my prior knowledge, and trimmed in such a fashion that I appear as a peaceful worshipper of legality, Quan Ming. So much the more would I like the introduction to appear unabridged in the Neozeit, so that this disgraceful impression will be wiped out. So I wonder if you can comment why the organs of the Second International would water down what I guess could be perceived as Engels's legal term, if one wants to think about it that way.
Yeah. Pre-First World War Germany wasn't a political democracy like it was in America or in France. It was still, I mean, there were elections and parties were existed, but they were strict. There were still limitations, and I suppose the leaders of the German Social Democratic Party were recalling the anti-socialist law in which they were banned, and their only outlet was speeches by their representatives in the Reichstag. So I presume that their way of thinking was that we can't be too radical and call for a democratic republic. In other words, we overthrow the monarchy and the exile of the Kaiser, because they would get banned. Of course, Engels was right. I mean, he didn't expect in Germany there would be a peaceful revolution. I mean, he was just saying that they should use the electoral machinery to try and make things better, to try and make it more democratic. But he didn't expect it would necessarily be peaceful. And in fact, it wasn't, was it? I mean, the way that the bourgeois republic was established in Germany was in the end by an insurrection which overthrew the Kaiser. So I mean, I think to answer your question directly, I think that they did it because they were afraid of what might happen if they came out openly and said, we want a democratic republic, we want to abolish the German monarchy. And they were afraid, basically. Well, I don't know. They could have been right, couldn't they? I mean, if they had said that, they might have been banned. But I don't know.
Any more? And don't forget the other people tuning in online are welcome to contribute as well by raising their hand. Jacqueline.
Can I just ask, did any of this Marxist-Leninism take place, or is it my imagination, in South America at any time? Like recently? Last 40 years, or am I thinking somewhere else?
I certainly wouldn't be the best person to answer.
One problem is that in Europe, Marxism means the views of Marx, but when it was introduced outside of Europe to Asia and Latin America, it was in the form of it was in the form of Leninism. So most of the people that call themselves Marxists and the thinkers in say Asia and Latin America are Leninists, but they call themselves Marxist Leninists. And in fact, it's only now, with the demise of the Soviet Union and China being evidently a state capitalist, that people in these parts of the world are discovering what Marx said, different from what from what Lenin said. But most of the movement, Castro and all these other what they call the people in Peru and Uruguay and so on, they might have considered themselves to be Marxists, but in fact, they were, you know, they were Leninists. I mean, the best of it, if you like, you know, Che Guevara, he actually did stand for a socialist society, but he believed it would come about through, you know, a minority of communists in control of the government, and then educating the people into socialism. But most of the others, I mean, I don't think what's his name in Venezuela claims to be, to be a Marxist, but I mean, you know, Castro didn't, and so the others. But they were basically, you know, Leninists who saw socialism as state capitalism, basically, they were just. They were nationalists who wanted to use the state to develop industry in their countries. But of course, it could only follow the same sort of path as in Russia by converting more and more peasants into wage workers. And then they're faced with all this problem of, well, they've got to exist in a capitalist world, so they've got to keep their production costs down and so on. So they urge the workers to to work harder and produce more. And there's no way out for them, is there? They're in power within a capitalist context, and they're forced. Well, same as in Russia, it's material conditions that decide what happens. It's, I mean, Lenin was much more of a voluntarist than Marx. It was a bit of a determinist, I think.
Right, thank you. Brian had his hand up and then Simon.
I always have the sense in Latin America with the revolutionaries, they actually saw the guerrillas as actually being the vanguard party, you know, instead of the Leninist one. So they were kind of Leninist, but, you know, with Guzman and Che, seeing the guerrillas as actually being the vanguard party. Who were conducting the revolution.
Interruption. What's a guerrilla? What do you mean?
An armed party. Fighting in the hills. Like Castro and like Guzman in Peru. You know, you had a guerrilla party, as it were, an armed rebellion against. And saw them myself as Leninists. In fact, didn't he call the spearhead with Guzman, you know, Marx? He talked about Marx, Mao, and me, sort of thing, as being the spearhead of the revolution, as it were, and being an armed rebellion, actually, as the equivalent of the Leninist party.
Thank you.
Simon and then Kevin.
Yeah, I think it's a mistake to try and make the wedge sort of distinction between Marx and Lenin, that Leninists are fine with violence and Marx and Engels weren't. I mean, Marx and Engels were red in tooth and claw, mainly because they didn't take on a lot of the hypocritical, frankly, bullshit about how everything's going to be done in a happy, clappy kind of way. Now, you know, if you set out to change the class relations in society, there is violence there. Not necessarily the violence that you're going to provide, but certainly the violence from the people who are going to stop you from doing it. And they're going to apply every single resource. So the way to keep things non-violent is to make things a fait accompli as far as possible by assembling as much force on your side as possible so there isn't any firing. If you go in half-heartedly, then everyone ends up getting shot in a football stadium, which has happened from time to time. So I think that, you know, whilst we have a notion of how we can achieve revolution in Western societies without having to take to the gun, we should never expect that. So it's like they're going to let us do this unless we prepared the circumstances sufficiently that it's just not possible for them to use mass violence against us. You know, that we've managed to sufficiently propagandise the army and so on and so forth.
Thank you. Kevin?
Is Lennon on sale again? Yeah, it's a life on Mars, David Bowie. Yeah, great stuff. Any other contributions, questions, jokes, anecdotes, personal revelations? Danny, yeah.
Mark said, "Foreign front, the emancipation of working class must be the work of working class itself." So when we do get socialism, communism, it will be a society that's come of age. And the thing is, if the working class are to do it, they have to overcome social conditioning that makes them juvenile, has them become acting like juveniles, and come of age. And that's and also a question for Adam. Did Marx ever refer to us lot as the human family in his talk?
Right, yeah, good point. And a question for Adam. Referring to people as the human family.
Yeah, he did actually, didn't he? Didn't you see this manifesto of the what's it called, the World Society of Revolutionary Communists? It says that communism is the ultimate form of organization of the human family. So he did use that word. But on the point that Simon made, you know, Lenin and a lot of Leninists insist that the only way to win control of political power is some sort of mass insurrection. I mean, they say that, you know, that is the only way. Now, Marx said that it was possible to win control of political power peacefully under certain circumstances. So they can't argue that. I mean, Marx expected that if in fact the working class majority did win control of political power, they would be faced by a slaveholders' rebellion. He thought that there would be some sort of violent reaction, just as happened in America when they tried to abolish slavery. But the thing is, at that point, the people in charge of the gun are the people in charge of the state, you know, and like Simon said, in fact, we, the working class, socialist-minded working class, would have control of the means of coercion and would be able to deal. What's the Chartist thing? Peaceably if we may, forcibly if we must. I mean, that's probably Marx's position. But the Leninists say forcibly we must. You know, and that can't be sustained as Marx's view. Anyway, to come back to Danny, Marx did use the word human family.
Right. Anyone tuning in online want to make a contribution, ask a question? Anyone else? Yes, go ahead.
I'm just curious to know something so the SPGB was established in 1994. What kind of challenge did the Russian Revolution confront the SPGB with? Or not so much Leninism, which we could say is like a mess, right? But like the Russian Revolution itself, like, today we have a talk about Lenin, like 100 years later. But how does that, SPGB was established before, so how does it change anything, or does the program continue, right? The struggle continues, but yeah, so just curious about that.
Yeah, good question. Adam?
Well, as a matter of history, the Socialist Standard, our monthly publication, came out every month, including during the period of the Russian Revolution. But one thing that we were clear about was that whatever happened in Russia, it couldn't have been a social revolution, and it couldn't have led to socialism. But the party wasn't entirely opposed to what happened there. I mean, they credited the Bolsheviks with trying to stop the war on the Eastern Front. I think also there was it was a bit like the Paris Commune. In other words, the workers might have taken power there, but they were in a hopeless position, so that whatever happened, it couldn't lead to socialism, even if it was, you know, some sort of workers' regime, which might have, you know, some of the articles suggested they might suffer the fate of the Paris Commune. So, but I mean, if you read as well the party's obituary of Lenin, it's surprisingly not hostile. It said that Lenin did grasp what was going on. Lenin knew that Russia on its own could not establish socialism, and it would have to pass through a stage of capitalism. I mean, you know, and he argued that against, you know, various left-wing critics within the Bolshevik party who wanted to continue, you know, war communism and things like that. So yes, it's all there on the historical record. In fact, all the issues of the socialist standard during that period are now online on our website, so people can have a look. And I mean, we got into, if you like, polemics with, you know, with Lenin itself, but what over dictatorship and democracy and you know, so we definitely criticised the Bolsheviks every time that they claimed to stand for socialism or to be established in socialism, and also they criticised their paper constitution, which, you know, with Soviets and so on, which there was no directly elected National Assembly. Everything was hierarchy of service. So it's all there. But our basic position was, the conditions in Russia are not right to establish socialism. You know, one, because it wasn't economically advanced, and secondly, because the majority of the population didn't want or understand socialism. But within that context, I mean, the Bolsheviks could have done something. They could have, you know, revived industry and things like that. But there wasn't socialist. I mean, we, in fact, were when it comes down to it, the only people of, if you like, pre-Leninist Marxist socialists in Britain who survived and were able to criticise the Communist Party of Britain and its antics from a Marxist point of view.
Jacqueline?
Yeah. You asked how it affected us, and I can remember walking into a branch meeting in London, South London branch meeting, SBGB, Socialist Party of Great Britain, where Gwynne Thomas, who's no longer with us, turned around and said, three disasters for the working class. The First World War, the Soviet Union and the Labour Party. The biggest load of crap that we've had to deal with is those three, in my view, and I agree with it. In the year 2000, he said that, and I think it's a feeling some of the members may agree with. Just wanted to get that in.
Can I just return to that?
Yeah, yeah, go.
I guess what I'm asking is, does it change how the strategy of the SVGB, because of this historically unprecedented problem of the Soviet Union, right? It's never been before. So would it create the impetus to, like, change a strategy or something? Like, did the SVG have to change because of it? I mean, that's the Adam one yourself.
I can't answer that myself. I don't think so.
Anyone want to?
I could answer.
Yeah, go for it, Padgett.
Well done.
It's not like we've got a strategy, like, you know, a central committee that works out the strategy and then gives it to everyone. It doesn't work like that in our party. I tell you what did change as a result of that is, instead of us explaining what socialism is to the working class, we spent our entire lives explaining what it isn't. Yeah. Because of these past. That's what's been doing.
Good point. Bill and Tabitha.
Well, just very quickly on that, I mean, they, if you look at some of the early articles in the Standard, when they talk about, you know, what we will do when we have the army at our back and we control the state, and I think that caused the Russian Revolution the tone of that. So not necessarily, you know, the object declaration of principles didn't change, but possibly there was a tonal shift about the use of the state and state power as a means of the revolution change. I don't think there's any change in the commitment to political action.
Okay, thank you. And, yeah, I can see the message in the chat, which I missed earlier. So Mark's asking, I suppose it's sort of related to what we've been talking about, really. How does the SPGB view Extinction Rebellion? And sort of parallel question to that, is climate change a likely source of change? Perhaps in the sense of galvanising people to think about their situation and the causes for it. Does anyone want, Adam or anyone else, want to have a go at answering the questions in the chat?
Well, actually, talking about vanguards, Extinction Rebellion consider themselves to be a vanguard. They argue that they only need 3.5% of the population to support them, and they can mobilise people to overthrow the government and to establish a government which will implement what they consider the measures necessary to deal with the climate crisis. So. That basically, they weren't democratic. But on the other hand, their intention is to draw people's attention to the problem. But I don't know whether they add anything to that, because I think it's fairly well known now that there is a problem, and so that I don't know. Well, they people are right to be concerned about this, but I don't think they're going about it in the right way. You know, they've got this undemocratic theory, and they've done some silly things. But the breakaway lot, and even sillier things, and what's his name? Just stop oil and things. So I don't think that tactic is going to get them anywhere. And are they? Does any more consciousness? Does consciousness need to be raised any more about this being a problem? You know?
I think Simon had his hand up a split second before Paddy. Simon.
All right. I was just going to say that our evidence seems to be that revolutions start as people's opposition to particular circumstances, and then they sort of get out of hand because there are all of these other problems that were there to be raised that people had just put up with before. For example, I think Ed or perhaps Adam or whatever would be able to come back on this, but I believe one of the reasons given for the French Revolution initially was a series of bad harvests that meant that basically people were starving, and then people were, you know, they were driven onto the streets or, well, you know, country lanes or whatever it is because of this fact. And in the same way, in 1917, you had the collapse of the Russian army. Due to frustration with the war and the way that things were going, and that then developed into a revolutionary situation. And of course, in different circumstances, it might have been that the 1916 mutiny in the French army could have developed into something more. So we tend to find that the particular circumstances lead to greater revolutionary potential when those questions also present themselves. So what I mean by that is when you look at, say, is climate change a source of revolutionary change, then what you would say, well, what's actually happening is it's just putting less, you know, there's less to go round within the situation. That basically, sort of like, you know, production isn't as easy as it was. And that means an immiseration well, you know, given that capitalists are running the place, the working class is going to get it in the neck, climate change. And that means that people might end up on the street on a climate change basis. But does that make a revolutionary circumstance? No, it's just like a bad harvest or losing a war. What, you know, that puts people on the street. But then you say, are there further questions that people are asking?
Thank you. Paddy?
Well, I was just going to quote the front cover of an issue of Jackdaw, you know, the ACG's paper. I can't remember which issue it was, but the quote goes, environmentalism without class war is just gardening. And I think that's really funny because it's true, and it relates to what Adam was saying. It's like, is all this environmental activity leading to more class consciousness? And in one way you can say, no, it isn't, because I think there's something very bourgeois and very perceptibly bourgeois, middle class and posh about environmentalism, certainly in this country. Like, this is why the Daily Star calls them Tarquins, you know, although they stole that joke off someone else. I can't remember who it was. But environmentalists are seen as posh, as you know, posh middle class, well off, you know. And this is why they do things like block roads, because they're pissing off the working class, because they're not really fundamentally part of the work. They don't have to go to jobs. You know, they don't have to hold three jobs down, this sort of thing. This is a perception. So there's that. In that way, there is no class consciousness, and it really is just gardening. On the other hand, you've also got, I think, a growing awareness among serious environmentalists that it isn't the problem being caused by capitalism are not fixable except by getting rid of capitalism itself. And I think George Monbiot is an example of somebody who's in a real bind, because he's the one who said capitalism is a weapon pointed at the earth. He's absolutely clear about that. His problem is that he doesn't know what to replace it with, because he thinks that the opposite of capitalism is Soviet communism. He is really stuck in a... Again, you know, he doesn't know what to do. So he's going to end up going for some reformist rubbish, I should think. But he's not the only one who's identified that capitalism is the cause of all this. You know, I think that's becoming a mainstream debate in the climate, especially among young climate activists. So in that way, I think they're approaching a sort of class consciousness, but from an environmental approach angle. And so that's perfectly valid. It's a perfectly valid way of doing it. You know, you don't have to reach a socialist conclusion from the point of view of class consciousness, but you do have to get there in the end from whatever direction you come.
Yeah. Thank you. Couple of other conversation in the chat. Can't see the previous question that led to that. Oh, yeah, there you go. If the Russian Revolution had failed, would it have benefited socialist ideology? And Adam replied, the Russian Revolution did fail, but not through the Bolsheviks being overthrown. And then Michael replies, but if it had been overthrown, any answers to Michael's question up there from anyone?
If it had been overthrown, can I just say what would have happened is that capitalism would have developed in Russia as it had already started to before the Bolshevik Revolution. It would have developed under what you might call market forces, as it was doing elsewhere in Europe. And I mean, it's obviously it's a what-if thing, but, you can't... If it had been overthrown, the rule of the Tsar was gone anyway, and you'd had the provisional government previously in 1917, who would presumably have set up some kind of bourgeois democracy, and that's the way Russia would have developed. Obviously, we can't be absolutely sure, but you know, it's a reasonable scenario.
Thank you. And Adam's replied there, that's what a lot of people thought would happen in 1929, but it didn't. And he said Stalin became a totalitarian dictator. Ian had also...
The Russia in two fronts, the revolution. If what happened with the revolution, because of all the knockbacks internationally and internal insurgents as well as external, they went along the path of a command economy. So that was by order, as opposed to the free hand of Adam Smith. So if it had been defeated in its insurgence, then it would simply have reverted to the free hand market. The big problem for Russia was the rest of the world, and the fact that White Guard continued to rebel. What they did get rid of was the aristocracy, but the problem then, in their inception, they had a new class. A new class emerged from the party, and surely that's always the danger of any revolution, that the new class replaces the old class.
Thank you. Any other contributions, questions, comments at all? No?
No one's got a hand up or any other messages online. So, Adam, did you want to make a sort of few closing statements to sum up at all?
Not really. We just, the answer to the question was, for a couple of years, Marx might be seen as a bit of a Leninist, but he repudiated that. And as Keith was saying last night, his basic position was that this would be democracy during the revolution and after the revolution. Nothing to do with Leninism.
Well, yeah, thank you very much, Adam. Yeah, thanks especially for being able to put the talk together and present it at such short notice. So, yeah, thanks, Adam, and thanks to everyone for contributing.